call the last case for the February calendar, 97-3483-CR, State v. Lucha. David Cook representing the defendant. Is that how the defendant pronounces his name?
Moga.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Dave Cook. I represent Kenneth Lloyd Moka, the petitioner in this case. This case involves Mr. Moka's misunderstanding and his attorney's misunderstanding of the terms of a plea agreement in this case, specifically the sentence recommendations that were going to be made pursuant to that plea agreement. And it also involves, because the motion to withdraw a plea was made prior to sentencing, the trial court's exercise of discretion in determining whether or not any fair and just reason standard for withdrawal of a plea was met. Now, there's a key fact in this case, a very critical fact. And that fact is that there was an agreement with regard to sentence recommendations in this case. Before I get into the substance of that agreement, though, I want to point out to the court that that fact was overlooked both by the trial court and by the Court of Appeals. There were two hearings on the motion to withdraw a plea in this case. The first one was brought prior to sentencing, and at the conclusion of that hearing, the trial court stated, "Normally, this is a quote, normally it seems to me that the sentence recommendations are negotiated as part of the plea agreement. It appears that this was not done in this case for one reason or another, and that's beyond me." Well, in fact, there was a plea agreement, and there were sentence recommendations that were made, agreements to make certain sentence recommendations under that agreement. The trial court simply missed that fact in ruling on the initial motion.
What, can you point to the plea hearing transcript in terms of page and line number that sets forth the terms of that plea agreement,
okay,
the sentencing?
The terms of the plea agreement are in the defendant's appendix at page A10. And those are set forth in the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form that was filed on the date of the plea hearing. Now, again, before I address the substance of that agreement.
I'm sorry. Is there anything in the plea hearing transcript itself that you can point to in terms of page or line number that sets forth those terms?
No. In fact, that's one of the problems in this case, is that the requirement that the terms of the plea agreement be put on the record at the plea hearing was not fully complied with in this case. At the beginning of the plea hearing, and this is in the appendix right after the plea form, starting at page 13, A13, trial counsel for Mr. Moka stated generally some of the terms of the plea agreement, but he did not state specifically what the agreement was with respect to sentence recommendations.
But didn't you waive that argument in the trial court? Didn't the public defender, Michael Wilmovich, specifically state that that was not part of this basis for this appeal?
Mr. Wilmovich stated that he was not going to raise a Bangert type of burden-shifting argument as the basis for his motion. Now, I believe the reason he did that was because his impression was that under the any fair and just reason standard, there was adequate grounds for the court to conclude, certainly under the facts of this case, that the plea was not knowingly and voluntarily entered. The Bangert violation is plain on the record, and obviously that's a factual matter, and anyone can determine that simply by reading the record, that that was not followed in this case. And I tend to agree with Mr. Wilmovich that this court doesn't have to apply a Bangert analysis in this case, because we're dealing with the any fair and just reason standard prior to sentencing, and we've got a very clear factual basis for the defendant's misunderstanding of the terms of the plea agreement with respect to sentence recommendations. Now, the Court of Appeals, again, missed the fact that there was even any agreement at all on sentence recommendations in this case. The Court of Appeals said, quote, the parties did not discuss sentence recommendations and no conditions other than dropping the felony charge were made part of the agreement.
But didn't the trial court judge specifically find Mr. Mocha's statement with respect to this plea agreement incredible? And that, in fact, all that Mr. Mocha was up to was essentially to gain some time or how do you deal with that? We've got a trial court's determination here that seems to sink you.
The trial judge made a determination that the asserted reasons for withdrawal of the plea were not credible. And what this court has to really assess, and I think this is really the nub of this case, in making a discretionary determination, the court has to use a reasoning process that takes the facts in the record and the legal standard, which is there a credible, fair, and just reason for plea withdrawal, and applies those facts and that legal standard together in order to arrive at a conclusion that no, there is no credible reason. In this case, there certainly was a credible reason for Mr. Mocha's assertion that he did not understand the plea agreement with respect to sentence recommendations.
But I understand that's what your client says. But at the hearing where Mr. Liptak, Mr. Liptak did state, he testified, that he never told your client that jail would absolutely not be recommended. He didn't tell Mocha that the agreement prohibited the state from recommending jail. That sounds to me like conflicting testimony from your client, and that the trial judge rejected what your client said and accepted what Mr. Liptak said.
There's no conflict between what Mr. Mocha asserted and what Mr. Liptak testified to. Mr. Liptak did not say that he never told Mr. Mocha that jail would not be recommended. In fact, he testified on five separate occasions that he told Mr. Mocha that jail would not be recommended. What he said was, I didn't tell Mr. Mocha that he couldn't receive jail as a sentence. And Mr. Mocha understood, sure, the judge is not bound by sentence recommendations. But Mr. Liptak testified that it was both his impression, his very clear impression that jail would not be recommended, and that he conveyed that impression to Mr. Mocha. So Mr. Mocha's understanding and Mr. Liptak's are very much in line with one another, and they both agreed that their understanding was jail would not be recommended under this plea agreement. The plea agreement itself suggests that. The plea agreement says we're going to have a restitution hearing first, and then contingent upon the outcome of that restitution hearing and the amount of restitution that's set, if Mr. Mocha can pay the entire amount of restitution up front, the state will recommend jail time. The state will recommend a straight fine and costs, okay, a monetary penalty. If Mr. Mocha cannot pay the entire amount of restitution up front, the state will recommend probation to ensure payment of restitution. Now, I'm suggesting, and I think it's very clear, that kind of a contingent sentence recommendation suggests that jail will not be recommended under the plea agreement, because the only way it could be recommended as a condition of probation is if Mr. Mocha can't pay the restitution up front. And you cannot imprison a person for failure, for an inability to pay a monetary obligation. And that's exactly what the district attorney was suggesting that he could do based on Mr. Mocha's inability to pay restitution up front.
Could you please decipher for me exactly what the notes say at the bottom of A10?
Okay.
On the plea agreement.
That's paragraph 11. I understand the terms of the negotiated settlement for my case as being plead to 3 misdemeanor theft charges, restitution hearing, followed by a sentencing hearing. DA agrees to either straight fine / costs or maximum of probation period to ensure payment of restitution.
What did the DA say about that?
The district attorney stated, and this, again, was not contested by Mr. Liptak, the district attorney said, we never discussed jail time. Mr. Liptak agreed. There was no discussion of jail time. But the there was no discussion of a lot of things that could have been suggested as a condition of probation. There was no discussion of fine as a condition of probation. There was no discussion of community service. Mr. Mocha's point is that agreement in itself suggests that jail will not be recommended as a condition of probation. The only way you could get to jail, the only way you could get to the probation term, is if Mr. Mocha can't pay restitution up front. And it's simply unlawful under this court's precedence to impose jail based on someone's inability to pay a monetary obligation, whether it's restitution or a fine. Courts are very clear on that.
But are you making any suggestion that the district attorney changed his position on this?
No, I'm not suggesting. This was a misunderstanding. It's not a breach of a plea agreement. It's simply a misunderstanding. And I think probably it's because this agreement wasn't placed on the record at the plea hearing that the potential for a misunderstanding here never came up, never came to the trial court's attention. And maybe it wouldn't have, even at the plea hearing. As soon as it came to Mr. Mocha's attention, when he went in for sentencing and the district attorney informed his counsel that he was going to recommend 90 days jail, immediately Mr. Mocha said, "I want to withdraw my plea. This was not my understanding of our plea agreement." And so there was no delay in this case. As soon as that misunderstanding came to the attention of Mr. Mocha, he sought to withdraw his plea.
What did his counsel say? What did Mr. Mocha's counsel say?
Mr. Mocha's counsel said, "I completely misunderstood the agreement also. It was my impression that jail would not be recommended under this plea agreement."
In the transcript of the plea hearing, the court went through a lot of this with Mr. Mocha. And the court says, "Do you understand I could refuse your request for restitution?" "Yes." "I could simply sentence you to the maximum penalties provided by law for these offenses?" The defendant, "Yes." The court, which could total, if I packed them all on, stacked them all on top of another, $30,000 in fines and 27 months in the county jail. The defendant, "Yes." Now, any misunderstanding, it seems to me, was, or for Mr. Mocha to speak up, was then.
No, Mr. Mocha fully understood what the maximum possible penalties were that the court could impose. The misunderstanding is, what can the DA recommend under this plea agreement? Okay. Now,
and did the judge ask him that?
No, that was not put on the record. The sentence recommendations under the plea agreement were not put on. That is the Bangert violation, the failure to inquire as to what threats or promises, and specifically what plea agreements with respect to sentencing recommendations were made in this case.
Well, could I ask once more, and I'm sorry to be so obtuse, is there any evidence that the district attorney promised not to make a recommendation for jail time?
The district attorney, when he was cross-examining Mr. Mocha's counsel, asked him leading questions to clarify the nature of the plea agreement. Now, this is a quote from the record. The district attorney said, "The agreement was he would plead to three misdemeanors, and if he could pay restitution up front, then we'd go with a fine and court costs." And Mr. Mocha's counsel says, "That's correct." And here's the next question. "And if he couldn't pay restitution up front, we were looking at probation, and we never actually discussed what any conditions might go with that probation, did we?" And Mr. Mocha's counsel says, That's correct. "But based on our conversations throughout the deal, especially since we had looked at restitution being paid up front, I anticipated that jail would not be part of the equation." And it was a misinterpretation. Well, that's a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the agreement, that jail would not be sought as a condition of probation, because you cannot impose jail as a condition of probation based on an indigent person's inability to pay $2,800 of restitution up front. He simply couldn't do it. So if the DA had been able to recommend jail, that recommendation would have come only as a result of Mr. Mocha's inability to pay that amount of money. And essentially, the court, in following that recommendation, which happened in this case, court did impose the recommended jail time. Mr. Mocha ends up in jail because he can't pay restitution up front. So his counsel is certainly justified in giving it that interpretation. Additionally, if you look at the specific wording of the agreement, the recommendation will be probation to ensure that restitution is paid. In other words, the suggestion is we want Mr. Mocha on probation in order to ensure payment of restitution. And that, in fact, really was the focus of the state's interest here. They wanted to get restitution paid. And if Mr. Mocha could pay it up front, we'll just give him a fine and costs.
Wasn't there discussion about how sentence recommendations would hinge on what came out of the restitution hearing?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And wasn't the state somewhat surprised at the amount of restitution that was settled on, whether it came out of the hearing?
I don't know if the state was surprised at that or not. Certainly the state was seeking much more than the court granted. Mr. Mocha was not surprised. Mr. Mocha knew at the preliminary hearing, when the same evidence was put on to establish the amount of loss here, he knew, and he complained to the trial court at the preliminary hearing, they're just guessing at amounts. They're just guessing. They don't know. And then when they went to the restitution hearing, the state put on the exact same evidence that it had at the preliminary hearing. Mr. Mocha put on additional evidence to show that his electrical usage had dropped dramatically from the prior years that the state was using as sort of a benchmark to estimate their amount of loss. But Mr. Mocha was not surprised. There is a suggestion, I think, by the state that Mr. Mocha decided to withdraw his plea after the restitution hearing, after seeing that the state's case on proving restitution was weak. But that simply doesn't comport with the record, because Mr. Mocha knew full well, long before that restitution hearing, that the state's evidence was very weak, and that essentially they were just guessing at the amount of restitution.
Could you clarify for me, has Mr. Mocha actually served jail time, at any jail time?
At this point, no, he is not. He is out on bail, pending the resolution of this appeal. I think what happened here and what this court has to review is the trial court's exercise of discretion in deciding that there was a credible, fair, and just reason, was not a credible, fair, and just reason for withdrawing the plea. And if you read the court's decision, there is no discussion of the plea agreement. There's no discussion of page A10 of the appendix that lays out what the sentence recommendations were in this case, and the fact that it was contingent on a restitution hearing, and the fact that if restitution was paid up front, jail would not be recommended. There's no discussion of that, yet that is the central fact of this case. That's what this case is all about. That is why Mr. Mocha sought to withdraw his plea. And so if the trial court arrives at a discretionary decision without any discussion of the key fact, a secondary fact, which is also key, is Mr. Mocha's attorney's testimony that he understood that jail would not be recommended and that he conveyed that to Mr. Mocha. That also is not referred to in the court's decision. There simply is no discussion of the facts of this case, the key facts of this case, in explaining how the trial court arrives at its conclusion that the asserted reasons for plea withdrawal are not credible.
Oh, I understand. Let me see if I can summarize your argument. The plea agreement is set forth in number 11 as your client understood it, and as the attorney said, understood it. And that because it only makes reference to the misdemeanor, only makes reference to restitution and sentencing hearing, and only makes restitution to courts and costs and restitution to and that there should be probation to ensure costs, you're saying what's missing from there is any reference to jail time, right? And if there's no reference to jail time, there was no intent that there be any jail time.
Yes, under the specific agreement in this case.
That's right.
In another type of agreement, maybe that wouldn't be a problem.
But your argument is because the absence of any reference to jail time means that no one contemplated jail time. Means that your client and his attorney did not contemplate jail time.
Yes, and that is because jail time was not contemplated if the restitution could be paid up front.
And the only one that contemplated jail time was the judge's statement, which said a $30,000 fine, 27 months in prison. I'm talking about that your client was aware. So I don't, contemplation may not be the correct phrase, but the record shows that that was the statement of the judge in this case.
The maximum amount of time that could be imposed in jail was explained and understood by everyone. And the district attorney contemplated jail time, but that wasn't discussed with Mr. Mocha or his counsel. There was a misunderstanding here.
And your position then is there was the DA contemplated jail time and understood the plea agreement to allow for that. Your client did not contemplate, your client and counsel did not contemplate jail time in the plea agreement. Therefore, you have a plea agreement that is essentially not an agreement because there was a misunderstanding. There's no meeting of the minds, if you want to use the contract terminology. Therefore, because there was an agreement without a meeting of the mind and the agreement was invalid, therefore you should have a right to withdraw the plea.
Yes.
Is that a simple explanation of your position?
Yes, that is correct. Essentially, what we have here is a plea that was not knowing and voluntary. It doesn't meet constitutional standards simply because Mr. Mocha and his counsel did not understand that jail could be recommended or would be recommended under this agreement.
And what's your lead case that says if there's the agreement is not fully understood, that it's justification to withdraw the plea?
There's two cases that address this. The Dudry case is a pre-sentencing plea withdrawal case that establishes that principle that misunderstanding with respect to sentence recommendations is grounds for withdrawing of the plea. Now, in Dudry, the court did not allow plea withdrawal in that case because there was an explanation of the terms of the plea agreement on the record as to sentence recommendations. The defendant said, "I understand those," and the defendant's counsel said, "I understand those and I've explained those to my client." Then the defendant came back after the plea was entered and said, "I didn't understand." And the court said, "Well, you had to have because I explained it to you on the record. You said you understood and your lawyer said you understood." In this case, we simply don't have that. It's not explained to Mr. Mocha on the record. Mr. Mocha never says he understood that jail could be recommended, and his lawyer says the same thing. His lawyer says, "I didn't understand that jail could be recommended." So this is completely different than Dudry. Then there's a second case, the Woods case, which is a post-sentencing case, a plea withdrawal case. And in Woods, again, you have the court reversing the conviction because the defendant's lawyer renegotiated the plea agreement with respect to sentence recommendations after the plea was entered, or after the initial agreement with his client as to what those recommendations would be, but he didn't notify his client.
It seems to me, and I get back to a question that Justice Babbage earlier raised, that your biggest hurdle is the trial court discretion in granting withdrawal, that you arguably can rather easily show, make a prima facie showing under Bangert, that there's a violation here. It wasn't placed, if it did indeed include jail time, it wasn't placed on the record. So you got that, you've made a prima facie showing. The burden goes to the state by clear and convincing evidence to show that it was knowingly, voluntarily made. And it's a discretionary call with the trial court, and the trial court exercised discretion, and that's where you got a problem.
Well, I don't really see that as a problem because it is a discretionary decision, but the evidence that discretion was actually exercised is not on the record. There's no reasoning process on the record. Again, if you look at the appendix at 41, A41, there's a single paragraph there where the court summarizes its decision, and it really doesn't go anywhere except to say the defendant's assertion is incredible. I don't believe it. It's incredible. Therefore, I believe the asserted reasons for the withdrawal of the plea is not believable. Well, obviously, if something's incredible, it's not believable. But at some point in the exercise of discretion, that court has to engage the facts of the case and has to explain what was it about this plea agreement that Mr. Mocha says he doesn't understand. Why is it incredible? It seems perfectly credible given the law in the state. I see that my time has expired here.
You may finish. Did you finish answering Justice Bradley's question?
I think if the court was going to actually exercise discretion in this case, it would have to address what was the plea agreement, what was Mr. Mocha and his attorney's understanding of the agreement, and then if the court's going to reject those facts as a basis for finding a fair and just reason, it has to give some explanation as to why those facts are not credible. It can't simply assert it's incredible. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
May it please the court. Here is exactly what the plea agreement was. This is a quote from page 2 of the plea hearing transcript. This is the plea hearing of November 27, 1996. This is the Bangert hearing, the hearing, the 97108, the Bangert hearing, whatever you want to call it, the hearing where the plea was taken. This is Attorney Liptak telling the court what the plea agreement between him and the district attorney is.
What page?
Page 2. This is document, I believe it's 80 in the record.
Got it.
And the date?
November 27, 1996. This is the guilty plea hearing.
Got it.
It said, this is Mr. Liptak's words. The state would be modifying and amending the criminal complaint to allege that of 3 counts of misdemeanor theft in this matter. My client would be entering a plea to those 3 counts this morning. Recommended disposition would be that the court accept the pleas this morning and then set up a time for a restitution hearing on this matter, because that appears to be the only major stumbling block at this time, period. There is no discussion whatsoever about jail. There is not even a discussion about probation. The primary focus here was, and it is clear from this, and this is what the trial judge found, the primary focus of the defense here was A, to reduce this 10-year felony to a 27-month package of 3 misdemeanors, and B, to litigate the question of restitution. Even though the defendant would be admitting the elements of the offense, he would still be free to try the issue of restitution, and that, in fact, he did later in February when there was a full-blown evidentiary hearing on the question of restitution. The trial court determined a specific dollar amount of restitution, which was admittedly quite a bit lower than what the state requested, but was still, in fact, within the felony range. $2,800 makes this still a felony theft, but because of the plea agreement, Mr. Mocha was able to receive 3 misdemeanors and reduce his exposure substantially. And with respect to the trial judge's findings and credibility and determinations, we have 2 different hearings here. We don't just have the post-conviction hearing, we also have the pre-sentence hearing. And you need to look at both of those. And the arguments are made at both. This is the, I believe, March 25th, 97 was the pre-sentence. It was actually the sentencing hearing, but the issue of the motion to withdraw was argued at that point, and the judge made specific findings and determinations at that point. Then the issue was brought up again in a post-conviction motion to withdraw the guilty plea. The same many of the same arguments were made, and the judge again made findings and credibility determinations. Now, one thing I need to point out, or several points I need to make, first of all, for the very first time today in this court, Mr. Cook argues that Bangert was not satisfied. consistently up until today, the defendant has conceded that Bangert was satisfied, that this was a constitutionally and statutorily antiseptic guilty plea hearing. That is clear in the post-conviction hearing testimony. It is clear in the arguments even before sentencing. No one is challenging the trial judge's conformance with 97108 or with Bangert. Simply put, the trial judge did absolutely nothing wrong here. And no one is disputing that the prosecutor did anything wrong here. The defendant conceded, Mr. Liptak conceded at the post-conviction hearing, that there was no plea agreement. There was no breach of a plea agreement on this point. And so the prosecutor did nothing wrong here. And apparently defense counsel did nothing wrong here because there's no claim that he was ineffective for giving what, in hindsight, looks to be questionable advice.
Mr. Brown, I'm sorry, can I take you back 30 seconds? You stated something, and I didn't understand if you meant it as a correction or in the alternative, about something about a plea bargain or a plea agreement. You said there was no plea agreement or there was no understanding of a plea agreement.
There was no agreement regarding a recommendation as to jail. And that is clear from, again, this page 2. And that the hearing itself, the Bangert colloquy, was perfectly acceptable. And there is no discussion of a jail recommendation because there was no jail recommendation. No one negotiated this.
But of course, there's no reference to that on the plea questionnaire. Based upon the defendant's understanding, he didn't say anything about jail time.
Right. It was not a topic of negotiation. No one.
So you're saying that the absence in question number 11 of any reference to jail time is indicative not that jail time was not going to be recommended, but that it was not a subject matter of discussion.
Question 11 simply says that probation would be recommended. There was no discussion of the conditions of that probation except one, restitution. Their probation, as we know, can have a multitude, a myriad of conditions. There was no discussion of any condition except restitution, which was foremost in the defendant's mind.
We're not talking about absolute truths here. We're talking about understandings and maybe misunderstandings. It isn't very hard for me to envision that if you look at number 11, the plea agreement, the questionnaire, that you have probation set forth, and that apparently maximum period of probation for payment of restitution. It doesn't take a big stretch to think that a reasonable read of that is, from the defendant's point of view, is that he's going to get probation, he's going to get a period of time to pay off the restitution. But he might be wrong. That might not be the absolute truth. Maybe he should have divined that there was jail involved. But you've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of these plea agreements. As I haven't seen thousands, but I've seen lots of them. Probation, hyphen, payment of restitution, period. And I would look at that and I would say, I bet you there's really jail there. I wouldn't look at that and say, I bet you there was really jail time there and they just didn't put it down.
And I've seen many guilty pleas where it says probation, state will recommend 30 days, or state will not recommend jail.
But then it's there in the plea advisement form.
Pardon me?
Then it's in the plea advisement form. And again, we're not looking for what was the plea agreement. We're looking for what were the understandings of the plea agreement.
Well, I think the understanding was that jail was wide open here. I think what we have here is not a misunderstanding, but a false assumption that only the defendant and his attorney had. They proceeded on treacherous ice, assuming that the state wouldn't recommend jail, but not getting that in writing, getting a recommendation in writing that the state would not recommend jail. And that is a critical distinction. The question, and whether we call it an assumption or a misunderstanding, again, that is precisely the sort of thing that is within the province of the trial judge when assessing the credibility of this sort of a claim. That the trial judge can look at this, as he did here, and say, well, you allege a misunderstanding. You say you didn't quite get what the state was going to do with respect to probation. But the fact is, and I can make findings of fact and credibility determinations such as the following. You didn't crystallize this. You didn't. It wasn't important enough for you to make this part of the plea agreement. You knew that you could get 27 months with or without a recommendation. You knew that your exposure was being reduced from 10 years to 27 months. You knew all of this. If jail was that important to you, you certainly would have done more to make sure that this became part of the record.
Well, did the trial court find that? I mean, when you read the part of the plea hearing and when Mr. Cook made reference, it struck me that the trial judge looked back and said that Mr. Mocha understood what he was pleading to, and he pled voluntarily, and he understood what the maximum penalties were, and he pled voluntarily anyway. But maybe I'm just not seeing it, but I don't see where in this record the trial judge says the point of dispute here is the plea agreement, the understanding of the plea agreement. And the state says this plea agreement, although silent about jail, I never promised I wouldn't say jail. And the other two say it's silent about jail because that never came up in the conversation. And all we wanted was restitution and probation. And that's what the fight's about. And if you believe the state, then you say, I don't believe the defendant. They all never settled in on jail time. They understood it was a possibility for me, and that's always true, that I'll give it. On the other hand, if you believe the defendant, or you believe that they, both of them, then there's a dispute here on a basic plea agreement. So where does the trial judge say, I find that there was no dispute?
No, there is no dispute as to the basic plea agreement. I mean, Attorney Liptak clearly stated that at the post-conviction hearing. He admitted there was no agreement with respect to jail time, with respect to the state's recommendation regarding jail time. There, and everyone agrees that there was no term of an agreement. He specifically said there was no breach of an agreement by the state. This is an assumption that the defendant made about jail time that turned out to be wrong. And in fact, that's not even true. It's an assumption about the state's recommendation.
That's right.
Out to be wrong. The judge actually, in one sense, rejected the state's recommendation. The state recommended probation, and he didn't order probation. He ordered 90 days straight time plus restitution. So in theory, the state could have recommended no jail, and because the defendant entered this plea knowing that the judge could impose up to 27 months, the 90 days should not have come as a great shock. It was certainly within the realm of possibility, and he understood that when he entered his plea. And I would point to the trial judge's decision at the March 25 plea hearing, pages 14 and 15, where, again, he specifically found that jail recommendation was not made part of the plea agreement. And if you'll bear with me, I believe at the post-conviction hearing, again, there was no discussion about plea withdrawal until after the restitution. There were two things that he found significant at the post-conviction hearing. The delay in bringing this, that this didn't come up until after the restitution hearing and the defendant got a peek at the state's case. But second of all, the fact that there's no evidence that the defendant actually misunderstood this. Mr. Mocha never testified. He never even offered an affidavit as to what his understanding was. We have Attorney Liptak talking about, I might have misled him. I might have, I discussed this with the DA, and, I really didn't think jail was going to be that significant, and I might have misled him in my discussions. Mr. Mocha doesn't tell us what his understanding was. That's a critical gap in this record. And I, this argument about this, that part of this misunderstanding was that there was, if you follow it all the way through, that in essence he would be in prison for not paying a debt. And I have to respond to that only because
it's being presented for the first time in this court and really should not be considered. In fact, I would suggest that had that argument been presented to the trial judge with something to back it up, that might have provided the judge, might have pushed the judge's exercise of discretion a different way. I just don't think it's appropriate for this court to even address that particular issue. After all, in order to prove that point, he'd have to show that he had an inability to pay as opposed to a refusal to pay, which I think could just as easily be inferred from this record and from this particular client's obstinacy throughout these proceedings.
Mr. O'Brien, let me ask you about another issue. The defense counsel makes the argument that what really occurred here was an Alford plea of no contest, and that the judge never made any findings in regard to strong evidence of guilt, never made those findings on the record. What's your response to that, if any?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's two responses. One, this ultimately became a no-contest plea and not an Alford plea. An Alford plea was discussed, and then Mr. Mocha and his counsel decided, no, they came into the hearing saying, well, we're going to enter a no-contest plea. Then it was discussed whether or not it would be better to enter an Alford plea. Ultimately, he decided, no, we'll go ahead with a no-contest plea because we're concerned about civil liability in this case. However, regardless how you interpret this plea, there was the trial judge meticulously went through the evidence to support whatever that plea was, whether you considered a no contest, an Alford, or a combination thereof. The fact is the judge, in fact, when they're discussing the prospect of entering an Alford plea, and I don't have the precise page numbers, but at that hearing, the judge specifically said, you know, in order to support an Alford plea, I have to find strong proof of guilt. And is there that in the record? And he engages both the defendant and the defense attorney in the colloquy, and they eventually come to the conclusion that there is a factual basis in the preliminary hearing and in the criminal complaint to support the plea. And I would suggest that that is sufficient not only to support a no-contest plea or a straight guilty plea, but is sufficient strong proof of guilt to support an Alford plea. And actually, a case I would cite for that proposition, not only this court's Garcia decision, but also the Court of Appeals decision in State v. Johnson at 105 to a second, where the proof of guilt was a lot, shakier than it is here. And this court the Court of Appeals independently reviewed the record because the trial judge failed to make a finding of strong proof of guilt. And the court independently reviewed the record and made its own determination that there is strong proof of guilt.
Counsel, I was looking at the transcript. It seems to me, and I may be mistaken, but first of all, in the plea agreement form, it obviously has a standard language. I understand the judge is not bound by any plea agreement or any recommendation made by the district attorney. And I understand the judge is free to sentence me. Now, does this go against or help or hurt? And I was looking on page A28 of the transcript, and I'm assuming that you have Mr. Liptek and then you have Mr. Gate. And Mr. Gate, we're talking about the dispositional phase, and the counsel says, Your Honor, the reason why we'd like to have the restitution hearing first, that it may affect the recommendation. Is he referring to, I assume he's recommending, the recommendation is he's talking about the plea agreement that, for lack of it.
And I guess my response to that is that points up again the critical importance of the amount of restitution that the defendant placed, that this was a significant motivating factor. I don't think it proves or disproves anything with regard to whether the state could make a recommendation of jail as a condition of probation or a recommendation of jail on straight time. That's more or less beside the point. What that proves is that what was negotiated as a condition of probation was restitution, and that remained as Mr. Liptek put it, the only major stumbling block was restitution.
and not any jail. I guess that's what I'm looking at.
Remained open, and I think that's what the trial judge concluded from all this, that while in some cases people do negotiate jail recommendations, in other cases they don't, that in this case the focus was on the restitution, the amount of restitution, and the reduction of the felony to misdemeanors. A recommendation of probation and see what happens. You know, obviously the defendant did not want to go to jail. No defendant wants to go to jail. But if you are concerned about zero jail time in a case where you know you can get up to 27 months in jail, and your exposure has actually been reduced from 10 years, it would seem to behoove you and your attorney to clarify that before you walk into a court and enter a voluntary and intelligent plea on the record.
Counsel, you used some of those same words or concepts earlier in response to a question when you said, with regard to the findings of the court on the issue of credibility, and you went on to say, well, essentially the judge was saying you didn't crystallize. You knew it was reduced from 10 years to 27 months, and you were saying it should have been put on the record. If jail was that important to you, you should have done more to make that part of the record. Your opposing counsel indicates and points to Appendix 41 for saying, look, if the judge exercised discretion, he didn't make a sufficient record in order for this court to review whether or not the exercise of discretion was erroneous. Your opposing counsel quoted and said, the court said, I find that's not credible, that's incredible, therefore I believe that his asserted reasons for the withdrawal of this plea is not believable. I don't believe it. And your opposing counsel says he didn't articulate more and should have. What illustration is there for the exercise of discretion with regard to his finding of credibility?
Again, I mean, I would point to both the trial judge's rulings at both of these hearings, and I think the judge went in detailed fashion in discussing why it is that this claim is just not to be believed, that it's in essence saying that this was not a major concern. And the judge looked at the timing of it. The judge looked at the fact that there was no plea agreement, that there was no claim of a breach, that in fact it was not discussed with the prosecutor to the point of making it a recommendation. The fact that the judge relied on Attorney Liptak's testimony, which basically undercuts this claim. Attorney Liptak says, one, there's no agreement, two, there's no violation of Bangert here, three, I might have misled my client, but it wasn't based on anything anyone promised me. What we really have here, if nothing else, we have a nascent claim of ineffective assistance, because the only person who arguably did anything wrong here was Mr. Liptak. No one else did anything wrong here. And as far as the credibility and the deference to the trial court's discretion, I would suggest the Court of Appeals had absolutely no difficulty relying on the trial court's reasoning here. And normally this court does not review questions regarding the trial court's exercise of discretion. And the Court of Appeals, I believe, gave due deference to those findings and credibility determinations based upon this lengthy testimony, not only at the post-conviction hearing, but the arguments at the initial motion to withdraw hearing and the preliminary hearing testimony, the restitution hearing testimony.
And Mr. O'Brien?
Yes.
You stated that, or at least implied, that you are somewhat puzzled as to why we took this case.
I guess there are a number of bases.
Now, why do you think we took this case and set it for oral argument for, you know, with two other cases involving plea sentencing? What's your understanding and what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess as these cases came in and we began to talk around the office, it became clear that the court is concerned with the procedures for taking guilty pleas.
Yeah. Do you think there's any concern with respect to this case, or do you think we should have no concern whatsoever?
Well, I think you should be concerned that defendants are not getting proper advice from their attorneys. I think you should always be concerned about that, especially when they come into court and say everything's fine at a plea hearing. And I think we should be concerned about that.
Is there anything we can do about that in this case?
The only thing I would suggest is I don't know if there's anything you can do. I mean, the law is out there. We have Banger out there regarding guilty pleas in general. We have Garcia regarding Alford pleas in general. We have all of the cases discussing what is and is not required to be proven to establish a fair and just reason. We have the materials that judges and defendants and prosecutors can follow, SM 32, 32A, 32B. Those are all there, and this court has reminded people over and over again how to do that. I don't know that there's anything else that can be fixed. I think at some point you just have to rely on the abilities of the people involved to follow the law. And again, in this case, nobody did anything wrong. The judge did nothing wrong. The prosecutor did nothing wrong. And if anybody did anything wrong, it was simply the defense attorney leading his client into a false assumption about what the state might recommend. And again, I would suggest, that happens probably more often than not. I think defense attorneys, when they're discussing plea negotiations with their clients, I'm sure often are asked the question, how much time do you think I'm going to get? And that if the counsel has to make an educated guess, and he might say something to the effect of, well, the maximum here is 10 years, but boy, I'd be surprised if you get more than one, but you could get 10. And the guy goes in and gets 10, and he comes back and says, you told me one. I think if we start reversing pleas on that basis, we are going to be inviting a number of appeals and post-conviction challenges that cannot even be imagined.
Well, the case law seems to, as it developed, take a strict line that the entire plea agreement should be put on the record so we wouldn't have these fusses, right? And then the plaintiff, the state can evaluate it, the defendant can evaluate it, the judge can evaluate it, and the judge is not bound and has a duty, indeed, to sentence in accordance with the facts, right? Regardless of the plea agreement. So now we don't have a very detailed plea agreement on the record. We have some scratch notes, in effect. What do you think this court should say in an opinion? What does the state want to see? I mean, the state wants good law made, right? So what kind of law should we have?
Well, I think this court should follow Bangert and say, as the defendant has conceded, there was no violation of 97108. There was no violation of the mandatory procedures. Therefore, he is not entitled to relief. It is as simple as that. And or at least the trial judge in his discretion could find that his asserted reasons, which do not prove a prima facie Banger violation, do not reach the level of a fair and just reason. I would suggest further a point of analysis that I think is useful is the D.C. Circuit's decision in United States v. Crade, where it's at 47 F. 3rd, and I'm not finding it right now, where the D.C. Circuit goes in. It's a 1995 decision. It's cited in my brief, and it relies on United States v. Barker, 514 F. 2nd, also out of the D.C. Circuit, which involved the Watergate burglars. And it discusses what a defendant must show in a pre-sentence challenge to a guilty plea. And it is very clear that there are three important factors in assessing a pre-sentence challenge to a guilty plea in determining whether a fair and just reason has been shown. Number one, did the plea colloquy satisfy Federal Rule 11, which is the equivalent of 97108 as supplemented by Bangert in Wisconsin? If it did, the defendant has an extremely heavy burden to overcome the presumptive validity of that plea colloquy. And even then, if the defendant claims innocence, that is not enough. He has to come up with he has to demonstrate to the court that he has a legally cognizable defense. Something that, or as another court said, a colorable defense. Something that has some indicia of credibility to it. And third, we assess prejudice to the state. That even if the defendant meets these first two burdens, if the state is substantially prejudiced, the judge, in his or her discretion, can deny relief. On the other hand, even if the state cannot prove prejudice, if the defendant fails to overcome the presumptive validity of the plea proceeding, then in all likelihood, the judge's decision to deny relief will also not be disturbed. And I think that would be, that nicely fits this unique situation of the pre-sentence motion to withdraw even an Alford plea into, coupling it into the Bangert requirements and the prima facie case rule. I really would strongly urge this court not to tinker with Bangert or not to add more mandatory procedures than are already present. That case, well, let's put it this way, there was a lot of bloodletting that went into that decision, I think. And I think it has proven over time a very strong and clear path for litigants and judges to follow. And people, we're never going to eliminate appeals. There will always be appeals. I think we're naive to think that if we tinker anymore, we might reduce the number of appeals. In fact, I would suggest that maybe the numbers of appeals have been reduced. In fact, this was a no-merit case here. But I would suggest that what Bangert did was that it reduced drastically the number of reversals for hyper-technical, unimportant errors that are... In the previous argument, somebody asked the defense attorney, why did the defendant misstate the elements of the offense? And the answer was, why did the defense counsel misstate the elements? And the answer was, well, he's human. And that's true. Judges are human, too, and prosecutors are human. Defendants are human. People are going to make mistakes. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater or slot a fly with a sledgehammer. Let's keep the procedures we have in place and reverse only when there is a truly unconstitutional plea.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Cook, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Mocha is being represented here today on a state public defender appointment as he was at trial. He's an indigent person. He does not have money. If Mr. Mocha had money, this case would not be here. Because if he had money, he would have paid his restitution up front, he would have paid his fine and costs, and the case would have been over. The case is here because Mr. Mocha doesn't have money, and therefore the second clause of this sentence recommendation agreement kicked in.
I apologize for interrupting, but that's of your knowledge, that was on a form that shows that, you're just saying this is the reason because he can't pay it, that's why you're up here?
The fact that Mr. Mocha is represented by state public defender
Is
of record.
Yes,
and the financial standards for that status are by statute.
Yes.
The fact that he didn't pay the restitution up front is a matter of record. And in fact,
he didn't pay the restitution. I understood they had a hearing, and he was charged with $6,000 and went down to $2,800.
That's right. And then the state's agreement was, and this comes out of the prosecuting attorney's own mouth at the post-conviction hearing, if Mr. Mocha could not pay the restitution up front, then we would recommend probation to ensure payment of restitution.
Mr. Cook, did the trial judge set a time frame within which restitution was to be paid?
No, he didn't. That whole approach, which this court has laid out for people who can't pay lump sum payments, was not followed in this case. And again, what this goes to is the assumptions that trial counsel made. And Mr. O'Brien indicated that if this argument about the fact that you can't imprison someone based on their inability to pay, if that had been made at the trial court, perhaps this case wouldn't be here either. That, to me, is an indication that Mr. O'Brien understands that the assumptions that were made in this case were not false assumptions. They were reasonable assumptions. It's very reasonable to assume that if the state says, I'm going to recommend a straight fine if you pay restitution up front, and I'm going to recommend probation to ensure payment of restitution if you can't pay that up front, it's very reasonable to assume that jail is not in the picture here. Because if jail is in the picture, the only reason it's in the picture is because this guy can't pay his lump sum payment.
Well, am I correct that if the restitution is not paid, that the state has the option of then asking for a judgment to be entered, a civil judgment?
That's correct. And the way that should have been handled and the way it would be reasonable to handle it while Mr. Moak is on probation is, first of all, let's make an inquiry into exactly what his resources are. Let's set up a reasonable payment plan. And then at the end of the probationary period, if he's made a good faith effort to pay those payments, this is under the Huggett case, H-U-G-G-E-D-T-T. If he makes a good faith effort and he's not been able to complete that payment plan, probation cannot be extended. The existing restitution can be converted to a civil judgment. And that certainly is what the reasonable expectation of trial counsel was in this case that would happen, not that the state would come forward with a jail recommendation. That's what should have happened. That's why the assumptions that were made in this case were reasonable and credible, and that's why the trial court's decision saying that the expectations were incredible is an erroneous exercise of discretion.
When's the first time jail was mentioned by the state?
The first time it was mentioned was when the parties went into court on the date of sentencing, and the state indicated to Mr. Moak's counsel, I'm going to recommend 90 days of jail. And immediately at that hearing, Mr. Moak's counsel indicated to the court, we're going to be filing a motion to withdraw the plea.
But
they did immediately.
How did this finally wind up? Did the judge give jail or probation?
The state recommended 90 days of jail, and the court imposed 90 days of jail. There was a suggestion that the failure to satisfy the Bangor requirements has been conceded. That has never been conceded in this case. It certainly was argued in the briefs.
Wasn't it conceded at the trial level?
At the trial level, the post-conviction counsel indicated that he was not going to assert Bangor and its burden-shifting analysis as a basis for relief. And I think that's valid in this case because you don't have to reach that in this case because we're dealing with a different standard. Bangor applies to the withdrawal of pleas after sentencing. Here we're dealing with a standard that is even more lenient than the post-sentencing standard. Any fair and just reason, and the courts have said courts normally should allow withdrawal of the plea, and that standard is to be liberally construed. So it's a more lenient standard than Bangor. You don't actually have to assert the Bangor analysis to get to the right result in this case. But certainly, the fact that there was a Bangor violation, it's on record. The plea hearing doesn't say anything about the sentence recommendations that were part of the plea.
Thank you. Justice.
I asked you earlier to decipher the scribbling at the bottom of the...